From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made in the future, not too many years from now. The Earth will begin to spin more slowly. A 24-hour day will become 24 hours, 56 minutes. But every day, the slowing will continue. Eventually, a day will stretch to 40 hours, then 50, and more. The government will urge Americans to adopt clock time, 24-hour cycles, even though that means some days we will wake up in darkness and come home when the sun is just rising. Some days will include 24 straight hours of sun, or even 24 hours of darkness. Crops will die, frozen by extended nightfall, scorched by extended daylight heat. Gravity will become stronger. Birds will be some of the first to die in large numbers. The ocean tides will change wildly, and large sea creatures will wash up on shores. That's the premise of Karen Thompson Walker's debut novel called The Age of Miracles. But the book is about more than just the disaster of the slowing. It's about the chaos that also envelops adolescence. The novel is told through the eyes of a girl named Julia, not yet 12 years old, in love with a mysterious boy at school, introverted and feeling increasingly alone, struggling with the shakiness of her parents' marriage. She worries about food shortages, sure, but also what to wear to impress her first crush. I started reading this book last night. I finished it this morning, and it is fascinating, instantly compelling. It's the selection of writers and books for their annual event, If All of Rochester Reads the Same Book. The author is coming to Rochester. But first, Karen Thompson Walker is my guest on Connections. And Karen, congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Also in studio is Joe Flaherty, Executive Director of Writers and Books. And Joe, you could have chosen anything. You guys always have the hardest job in Rochester, choosing one book. I love your choice. How did you end up choosing The Age of Miracles?
Well, you know, first of all, let me say a quick hello to Karen. You know, it's good to meet you in the radio sphere, and look forward to meeting you when you get here in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Well, you know, we read lots of books every year, and we're looking for ones that can really engage the community and can engage different audiences. And this book was one that we thought, you know, this can reach young adults and their parents and older readers of all kinds. It deals with looking into the future and seeing what the possibilities might be if this fragile world, this environment that we lived in, started to change. And we thought it was beautifully written, and we always look for that. So it's a book that's entertaining in the sense that you enter into it, you enter into that world, and also informative and elucidates what might happen as a result of such an event.
Now, if you want to get involved with If All of Rochester Reads the Same Book, Joe, what are the details coming? I know Karen's coming here, but you're encouraging people to pick up the book now, read it, and again, I did it in...
Well, we'd love for, I mean, a lot of people have read it, but there's going to be a number of book discussions that take place even before Karen comes here. For instance, even today at the Rush Public Library, there's a book discussion. There's going to be a book discussion on Monday at the Highland Library, Arnett Branch Library next Thursday. So there's a number of events where people have a chance to meet other people and discuss the book. And all that's available on our website. And then Karen will be here starting on Wednesday, March 18th. And again, she'll be doing a number of public appearances throughout the community, all of which are open to the public. She'll be at St. John Fisher College. She'll be at Nazareth College. She'll be at the Penfield Public Library. She will be at the Central Library of Rochester, at Rochester Institute of Technology, the Wood Library in Canandaigua, so people who live a little further south have a chance. She'll be at Valley Manor, which is Senior Living Center. So there's multiple chances for people to come hear her, ask questions about the book, and get involved in a discussion with other people from around the community, and also get their book signed.
Well, Karen, again, the book is The Age of Miracles and the Slowing of the Earth. That is at least the dramatic peg that is not a human. There's a human drama that I love, and we're going to get to that coming up here. But there's this disaster that's unfolding. Where did that idea for you come from?
You know, I got the idea from something that really happened in a much smaller way. I mean, the change in the Earth's rotation was much smaller, but this was back in 2004, you know, the earthquake that caused the tsunami in Indonesia that year. I remember right after that hearing that that earthquake was so powerful that it had actually affected the rotation of the Earth. So in that case, it actually sped it up by a tiny, tiny, you know, few milliseconds per day. So after that, our days were just ever so slightly shorter. And I just was so struck by that news. I had no idea at that time that that was possible. And it actually, something similar happened after the earthquake in Japan a few years ago. But anyway, that little kernel is kind of, I don't know, in a way, fear and horror, but also sort of wonder lodged in my imagination. And I just started to wonder, you know, what would happen to us? What would happen to the planet? What would happen to the environment if a much, much larger shift in the rotation of the Earth ever were to take place? So that was where it began. And I just started writing a short story about it. I was in graduate school at the time working on short stories, studying creative writing. So it was maybe about a 13 or 14 page short story in which there was this just a 1 hour change in the rotation of the Earth, in the speed that resulted in a 1 hour change in the length of the day. So then with the novel, it became much more extreme, but that's where it started.
And you were talking about speeding it up, but then for your novel, you decided to slow it down. And my thought, picking it up, I say every day, if only there were more hours in the day. But it turns out that if that actually happened, it really would be disastrous. And so when the novel begins, it opens right with the news that scientists have figured out that this has happened, that a day has become 24 hours, 56 minutes, and every day is getting longer by sizable chunks, or about a half hour a day for a while. And there is a part of me, Karen, that immediately thought, oh my goodness, the science of this is going to be fascinating. But your narrator is a not yet 12-year-old girl. And then I thought, oh no, well, see, that's a good way for her to get around the science. But at the same time, it became clear. This book is not going to be a what-if science exploration. So how did you approach deciding how much information on the science side do I want to include?
Yeah, that is definitely a tricky thing with this premise. But I guess my main goal was always to make the book feel as realistic and authentic as it possibly could. But I did that by focusing on kind of what the human everyday experience of this huge event would be. And in a way, the fact that, just to be clear, no scientist is concerned that anything like this is going to ever happen. So that means that there isn't, there's not sort of tons of research on everything that would happen or on what could cause such a large change. And so in a way, it seemed like if tomorrow we woke up and this did happen and our days suddenly were, much longer. And in my book, it's not an earthquake. It's just a mysterious cause. If that happened in real life, I think it would take our scientists, a long time to figure out why something so unexpected had happened. And so in that sense, it felt more realistic to not go into too much science, because it would be a sort of inexplicable mystery if that happened tomorrow to us. Mm-hmm. And you're right that the fact that I focused so tightly on a young girl's experience and her family's experience of what the effects of this change would be. I'm interested in that age and in sort of the tumult of adolescence and sort of family life. So that's partly why I chose it, but it did also help me explore this, very unlikely premise without having to, I didn't want there to be, fake science in the book. So it seemed like a better option to sort of tell it from a point of view where she doesn't have that much access to the science. And also the scientists in the book are kind of baffled by what is happening.
We already have a question from a listener who wants to know, over how long of a period does the slowing occur? And as I mentioned, it's happening pretty quickly in terms of adding, if I remember correctly, about half an hour, give or take. Every night's a little different. Scientists are calculating how many minutes did we lose, but it doesn't take long, weeks or a few months, for a single day to be 48 hours. And watching the panic and then trying to normalize and then panic with new information and trying to normalize. But you did have to think about the ways that human beings would grapple with disaster. It doesn't have to be the slowing of the Earth. It could be crop issues, perhaps climate change or other events, and you thought about the human psyche. You thought about food stockpiling and all of those things. How much did you actually look at the way people behave in crisis when you wanted to create that atmosphere in the book?
Yeah, I thought a lot about that, about, you know, the sort of slightly smaller scale disasters that happen all the time in our real world. I tried to learn from that. And also, in a way, the book is partly about the kind of anticipation of disaster and the fear of disaster, because changes are happening as a result. I mean, in the book, changes are happening to the Earth as a result of the slowing. But in a way, I think the scariest thing for the people going through it in the book is what will happen next. And that sort of fear and anticipation is something that I think is very familiar and a part of life, probably at any time in history. But certainly, I think we in our current moment are, you know, very susceptible to that, because there's so many different kinds of, you know, chaoses that are happening, and we don't know what the future holds. And so that was a feeling that I was interested in tapping into, you know, whether it's you know, war or climate change, and the fact that we can't predict those things, that's just part of human life. So that was easy in a way to tap into, but certainly in the book it tightened. And I also thought a lot about my own experience growing up in California, which is a place obviously that has a lot of natural disasters. And even though I never was a victim of a you know, major earthquake, the fear of earthquake and the fear of earthquakes and the fear of brush fire did have a way of kind of affecting my psychology, I think. And in a way, I definitely was worried as a child about earthquakes and what would happen if there was an earthquake in the middle of the night, or when I was at school, you know, what would we do? But on the other hand, I also, the way that Californians do, I got used to that, you know, and in a way, I think it's just as fascinating to think about how people manage to carry on in the face of disaster and carry on in the face of radical uncertainty, which certainly is something I tried to capture in the book and something that I learned, I think, watching the way that people live, you know, in California.
My guest is Karen Thompson Walker, the author of The Age of Miracles. Writers and Books selected it for their annual event, If All of Rochester Reads One Book. And this is the book. The events are happening this month. You can go to Writers and Books website to check out the events, public discussions, and then find out when you can meet Karen when she comes to Rochester in a couple of weeks. Now, we instantly ache for Julia, the protagonist, who is lonely and only child, not yet 12 years old, struggling with kind of the breakup of friendships. And how much of your own childhood is in Julia? I'm curious.
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think the sort of feeling of the childhood, of my own childhood, is definitely captured in Julia. The actual events, you know, what happens to her, you know, the troubles between her parents or the particular problems she has with her friends are mostly invented. But just that feeling, that kind of extreme sensitivity that so many people have when they're, you know, 11, 12 years old, when they're sort of crossing into the first beginnings of teenagerdom. All the way that Julia feels at those times, and the fact that she feels like she's a little quieter than the other kids and maybe a little more childlike than the other kids who are growing up so fast, all those kinds of feelings I definitely drew from my own childhood as sort of a similar young girl. But Julia has a much worse experience of adolescence than I did. I say that if I'd written a story that really was about my real childhood, there wouldn't have been enough drama.
Now, Julia is living with her parents. Mom wants to get back into acting. Dad's a doctor. They're sort of drifting apart. And they, in their own family, approach the slowing of the earth very differently. Tell us about that.
That's right. Yeah, well, I thought it seems likely that people with different personalities would have a different, you know, would react in different ways. So in Julia's family's case, Julia's father is sort of very stoic and is trying to just carry on and not obsess about the worst possible version of events. and try to just keep things, keep moving. You know, he, even on the first day, he still goes to work at the hospital because he has a shift there. And because, you know, he figures people may need him even more, need, you know, doctors even more on this day. But Julia's mother is sort of prone to anxiety even before the slowing. And so she is very worried and very upset and, you know, stockpiling food even before it seems to be necessary. And so I think they both, that's part of probably what pulls them apart to some extent, is that they have such different approaches, and Julia is sort of caught in the middle.
Now, some people resist the government's urge to use clock time. The government decides, you know, we don't know. Scientists are telling us the Earth is slowing down. We don't know what that means in the short or the long term, or if it will stop, but we've got to get back to clock time, a 24-hour cycle, because, you know, if we all had 25-hour days, Joe Flaherty and I would be thrilled. We'd find ways to fill that extra hour, be productive. But
right.
the more it became 30 hours, 40 hours, it's very difficult to get into what they call a circadian rhythm and to be awake during the day and asleep during sundown. And so the government says, get on clock time. And some people decide they think that's kind of a government conspiracy. It's a control thing. They withdraw from society. They create their own colonies. You didn't really disguise some of the parallels, not to any one group, but some of the apocalyptic talk that we hear in political commentation today, I thought.
Yes. I think it's been a few years now since I was writing those sections, but certainly it felt like a familiar divide that... And not just political, not just the two sides, the two sort of American political sides, but just this divide between trusting the government and wanting to stay in sync with society versus feeling like society is, oppressive and the government is out to get you, you know. And so in this case, it just seemed very, very likely that some people, as soon as the government said you need to be on the 24-hour clock, even though it no longer is in sync with night and day, it just seemed like there'd be a variety of different kinds of people on both sides of the political spectrum who would find that objectionable and want to stay sort of in tune with the sun, even though, as you point out, that becomes more and more extreme. You know, it becomes harder and harder to stay in sync because the nights get so long and the days get so long. And certainly once some people are living that way, when some people are living, the real timers living, as they call themselves, are living according to the sun instead of to the clock, they are living on in sort of a parallel universe, even though they're in sometimes living on the same street. So they certainly couldn't easily sort of interact with the rest of society once they make that choice.
Colleen on Twitter says the first few weeks of the book sound an awful lot like living in Anchorage, Alaska. And actually, Colleen, Karen writes in the book that there are parts of the globe that we do see. I think, Karen, some parts of the globe toward the poles, right? 24-hour day or 24-hour night at times
right.
of the year.
Right.
What's interesting about that is the kids the adolescents, Julia and her friends, they admit early on, they kind of viewed this with a sense of wonder, kind of, you know, as an adult, we would probably be stocking food and panicking and trying to calculate how long until the Earth might stop and what happens then. The kids are kind of thinking, we're waking up in the night early on, we're you know, going to school when it's dark. To some degree, it was kind of cool. And that, I thought, for me, that grounded it. As opposed to just being a disaster crisis novel, it became, that snapped it back to, well, we are dealing with adolescents, and adolescents do have dramas from what clothes they wear to other things. And, you know, to them, it was kind of cool for a little while, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think there is sort of a thrill to it, especially before the worst consequences start to land, because it's just so different and so unexpected and true that in adolescence, I think, are attracted to drama.
Yes, and Julia as well. She has it bad for Seth. He is a mysterious boy who, kind of unbothered by the pressures of adolescence, he's kind of floating above it all. And without giving too much away, I took great pleasure in finding out that Seth was disguising some of the same angst about Julia that she was about him at times. And I wanted to give the book to the the kids in my family who are the same age, who occasionally go through the same emotional struggles, I wanted to say, look, even Seth, who's super cool, he was confused about stuff, which I think a lot of people would relate to.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, I hope as soon as I came up with this kind of disaster idea, I realized it could be this way to look really closely at those kinds of small relationships that, you know, 11, 12, 13-year-olds have that mean so much at the time when you're going through it. But then I think sometimes when we're older, you look back on that and it seems like just kid stuff, you know, not important in some way. But I thought in the context of this huge disaster, it felt like it was a way of kind of giving back this feeling of sort of dignity and tenderness to that time. In the book, it's, you know, possible that this will be the last generation that gets to go through all those ordinary, you know, highs and lows. So it's fun to look really closely at those.
Yeah.
Times.
Yeah, my guest, Karen Thompson Walker, the author of The Age of Miracles, a book with starts with the premise of the Earth slowing down and losing time, essentially every day getting longer by the day. There is understandably a panic that ensues. Birds start to die in larger numbers first. Whales are beaching. The tides are changing. Gravity is getting more powerful as a force. And so there's a lot going on. But most of the kids, if I remember correctly, something like 75% or 80% of the school, the kids stay in school. They try to keep going on with their lives. The government's urging people to try to keep on keeping on as they try to figure things out. And so Julia keeps on keeping on, and she's worried about Seth. They finally get this afternoon together. And so your book took me back to my own childhood because they had this afternoon where they go, they kind of go exploring. They see a beached whale. And Julia's thinking, this is the start, finally, that I'm going to be able to, you know, I can build on this with Seth. And she spends a lot of time thinking, exactly what do I say? What's the first thing I say to him at the bus stop the next morning, which is awesome. I love that part. And she worried about what to wear. I remember my own childhood, Karen. I think I was in sixth grade. I think Dana Jensen, who's probably not listening right now, I have no idea where she is. I would call her. But I would write down a list of topics to talk about so I didn't run out of things to say.
Sweet.
And your book is the first thing that made me realize I might not have been the only one to do stuff like that.
No, you most certainly were not.
Well, go ahead, Joe.
I just wanted to jump in with a question while we're talking about Julia and Seth. Being a bit of a literary detective, I wanted to ask you, we have Julia, we have two young, let's call them lovers, even though it's too young to be lovers. But we have Julia, which is somewhat like Juliet, and we have Seth Marino, and within Marino is Romeo. I was going to ask if there was anything intentional about that, or if, but it sounds like it's not.
No, but that's interesting. You know, I think you're the first reader who's ever noticed that, but I like it. I didn't think of it. Sometimes, though, you know, when authors, I think when I was about Julia's age and I was first learning how to closely read books and write essays about them, sometimes I was skeptical of really elaborate, you know, if a teacher would say, like, look, see here, you know, Julia's named Juliet and Romeo's in his last name. Like, I would think, really, would the author really think of that? But now what I think is that even if they didn't think of it, it still could be that something about the mood of the book, it actually was triggering in the author's mind, like subconscious associations. So it certainly could have happened in that way, sort of subconsciously. But I didn't do it on purpose, but I like it.
we've established, and again, I'm trying not to give too much away of the plot here, so I'll gear it back in a moment, but I do have to say I'm going to read one of my favorite passages in the book because as we've established, Julia and Seth had this day. Seth blows, so she's waiting for this bus stop encounter, trying to say the right thing. He shows up late and blows by her, sits down on the bus, and she thinks, "Oh my gosh, you know, it's cold shoulder again." And they drift apart. She's basically devastated, and finally, I think it's days or maybe weeks later, he he kind of invites her to hang out again, and they're hanging out again, and she, and he says to her, he basically says, "What was your problem? You know, with the at the bus stop that day?" And she kind of says, "But wait, what was your problem?" And she's realizing that he was feeling what she was feeling, and she was feeling what he was feeling. And I love this passage. Let me read this. This is from Julia's perspective. Julia says, quote, "They say that humans can read each other in 100 subtle ways, that we can detect messages in the subtlest movements of a body, in the briefest expressions of a face. But somehow, on that day, I had communicated with amazing efficiency the exact opposite of what I most wanted in the world." That not only is a beautiful passage, but doesn't that sum up adolescence? I mean, middle school was tough, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's true. Well, thank you. Yeah, it's true. I mean, so much of growing up is about, I mean, I think probably our whole lives, just like sort of always adjusting and trying to learn how we're coming across to other people and how it might be falling short of what we mean.
Well, We're getting at least, and we're going to talk about the reception of the book and the amazing things that have happened since the book was released. And it's been out a couple of years now, Karen, is that right?
Came out in 2012.
Yeah, which probably feels like ages to you now.
Well, I had a baby since then, so in a way that has a sharp divide between then and now. But in some ways, it still feels new to me.
Well, it was to me remarkable as a reader that I found myself eventually caring even more about the personal dramas. Julie and Seth, for example, Julia's grandfather was missing, Julia's parents are kind of on the rocks. I found myself caring more about them as I went throughout the book than what was going to happen on the scientific side of things, though you know in the back of your mind it's still a fascinating question and you know something has to happen. As the writer, as the author, did you start this book knowing how it would end on that scientific side?
Not exactly, no. I mean, part of the fun of writing a book, I think, for me, is following along at the same time as the characters are, you know, so I'm figuring out what's going to happen at the same time, or, you know, just before the characters are finding out what's happening. So that's the way I wrote the book. I wrote it in order, and sort of each chapter, I tried to think of what's the most logical thing that would happen next. And so I didn't know how it would end, and the ending was also hard to figure out. I had a sense of the kind of emotional note that I wanted to end on more than on the scientific outcome. But I had chosen this, you know, this voice of technically an adult Julia looking back on her childhood. So that opened up this time where, you know, it had to be true that humanity continues existing at least until Julia is old enough to tell this story.
Sure, but we didn't know exactly how much of humanity or where,
right.
Or you know, those
right,
are all those are all questions that you gave cues even early on that there would be some survival of humanity, but it was always an open
right.
question of what. Did you map out? Did you do anything like mapping out different scenarios, or did you kind of just feel it out as an author when you got to that point of the writing?
I mean, I thought a lot about different options, but I didn't make the sort of final choice of exactly where I would end until I was close to the end, you know,
mm-hmm.
until I had maybe 40 or 50 pages left.
And so. Did you, you certainly, I think, subscribe to the notion that you don't have to spoon-feed an audience a perfect, happy ending to every storyline in a book?
Well, yes, I definitely think that's true. Yes, I think the ending, my ending has been a little, there's been a sort of wide array of responses. You know, some people will say, my favorite part was the ending. And then some people will say, the one thing about it that I didn't like is the ending. So, it's hard to satisfy everyone. But yeah, I mean, I wanted it to feel authentic. You know, and I think in general, I like novels that arrive wherever they do arrive at the end, whether it's, you know, a sort of classic happy or classic sad ending. I like for it to feel authentic and true to everything that came before. So I knew I didn't want there to be some sort of magical solution at the last minute in my book.
Well, let me ask Joe Flaherty, and we're not going to give away anything. My last question for Joe before we get our quick break in here. Joe, ending okay with you?
No, I think it makes complete sense. I mean, the one thing about it, which you might not have known leading up to the ending, is that it's being told from the perspective of somebody who's in their 20s. So we know that, but you don't know that till the end.
I couldn't tell reading it. Is she 18? Yeah. Is she 38?
Right, we 50? Don't. I mean, we have hints that'll say things like, well, later on people discovered. So you know that there's a later on that's there. But we don't know really how old the narrator is. So we don't have a sense of exactly how long, you know, we're going to be going on. But the true ending, I think, is what the two of them wrote in the cement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, careful, Joe.
I'm not going to say what it is.
Joe.
But the true ending is to me, that emotional ending to it.
Our engineer, Val, through the glass, just threw her hands up. Val, you're sitting here going, you're going to read this, aren't you? And now, see, she's nodding yes. Val, I promise you, this is absolutely your book. All right. Joe, I'm going to cut you off. We're going to take our 60-second break before you give away the ending of this book. We're going to come back, and if you're just joining us, Karen Thompson Walker is on the line with us. She's the author of The Age of Miracles. Writers and Books has selected it as their If All of Rochester Reads the Same Book, and it's always a tough decision for them, but they've chosen one that's a fascinating book. They've got events starting now and going throughout the month. We're going to recap those coming up and talk more with the author. So short break, and we're not ruining the ending next. I'm Evan Dawson. On the next Connections, it's Arts Friday. The first Friday of every month is our chance to get in touch with the arts community in Western New York. And this month, we're talking about Greentopia. The festival is back later this month. We'll catch up with them and the folks from the Fast Forward Film Festival as well. Join the conversation on Arts Friday on Connections.
A new poll shows that fewer young people see gender as limited to female and male. We meet transgender school children who agree.
Sometimes I say, I'm a girl. Sometimes I say, I'm a boy. Sometimes I say, does it really matter?
Students redefining gender identity. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I have to say, our engineer Val is one of the cooler people I know. But Val is probably the kind of person who, we all know people growing up, and maybe we were those people who, you hated that part of adolescence where you had to try to figure out what was cool and try to be that, even though it totally felt uncomfortable. And, you know, that's where, again, it doesn't matter if we're exactly like Julia. I think we all can find a time in our life where we think, I don't want to do this. Why, Joe, probably in our own, there has to be somewhere in your own childhood where you think, why was I conforming to that? That was ridiculous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's why getting older is actually, you know.
A joy, comes with it, yeah. Letting go of that care.
Exactly. But let me also say, I mean, I'm looking out the window here now and I'm seeing snow again. And I'm thinking, you know, in some ways with this program, Rochester Reads the Same Book, you get lucky. And I think February has been lucky for us and this book. I mean, it has been horrible, and everybody's questioning, what's happening in the world? Why is, you know, this is the coldest month ever on record here, and you look at Boston, and so you really get a sense of, you know, you really can't count on what's going to be happening next. And this book is a perfect example of taking that to an extreme and make you think, what would happen if? Because you look at February here and throughout the entire country is, what if this gets worse? I mean, what if you keep having winters that get worse and worse like this? And it does make you stop and think. And this book is a way of getting into that world and carrying it to an extreme.
I couldn't agree more. And Karen, I wonder if what Joe is saying, you've probably heard that from a lot of people, but it made me think it did not make me think, what happens if the world stops spinning? But it made me think, if climate change accelerates, or if we get really out of control with nuclear proliferation, or there are certain things that could happen that would lead to the government getting on every channel like they did right at the start of your book and saying, Everyone watch. There's something wrong here. I mean, we all felt that way in 9/11, but it could be an even wider scale. I'm sure you've heard from people who've told you that.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the things. I mean, I tried to think about those various possibilities and how we might, or how we in government might respond, but certainly people have said that it's made them think of various, I mean, definitely climate change, but also other kinds of things that could happen. And I like the idea that it's sort of generated, that it has a sort of thought-provoking element for people. And I also think, I guess, sort of my other favorite thing that people sometimes say is how reading about a world in my book that is changing so radically makes them sort of value in a refreshed way just our ordinary world.
Oh,
how,
yes.
You know, fragile it is, and how, but also just sort of how miraculous it is, you know, that birds, in our real world, birds are alive and well. I mean, you know, certainly some are facing extinction in some parts of the world, but I mean, you know, the birds still exist, and the sun still comes up at the right time each day, and, you know, for the most part, our natural world can still sort of manage the things that we're doing to it. But I like the idea that it's making people think, you know, if we took it further, if it got worse, or if we don't start taking better care of the earth, that, you know, that it would be obviously a terrible thing, some of which is maybe imagined in my book.
Well, to that point, and to Joe's point, it had me thinking about what's amazing to me is when people say, I'm bored. I don't understand that at all, because what we do know is that eventually human life on this planet will be very altered or gone. We don't know if that is a million years in the future or 10 million or a billion or 100 years. But we know that will happen eventually. And the notion of being bored with this amazing, unbelievably unlikely comfort that we have, is, and your book just made me think even more that what if I was unlucky enough to be born in the generation that things really went nutty, as Julia was. And it makes me look around now and say, I can't wait for the next time I'm bored, because I'm not going to be bored. I'm going to grab a cup of coffee and a book, and I'm just going to enjoy normalcy as I know it. You know?
Right. Oh, well, that's nice. Yeah, the idea that just what's ordinary is actually really ordinary for us is actually really extraordinary.
Joe, do you obsess? Am I the only one who obsesses about this stuff lately? I feel like lately.
Well, I mean, one of the great things about reading and being a reader is that you come across books that make you stop and think like that.
Yeah.
You know, you can go through your everyday life and you don't think that way, perhaps, but you read a book and it makes you say, wow, I mean, this is, think of what a wonderful world we have in which we, you know, are able to go around and you know, have our lives and have food and you know, live basically a very good life. And what if that was different? And it makes you appreciate it more. So, yes.
Absolutely. Now, Karen, do you have any people nitpicking, I think, unnecessarily about the science? I think that would be like looking at a Beatles album and being upset that it's not Mozart. I mean, it's not meant, it's not aiming to be. You know, but did you get any complaints about that?
Yeah, I mean, some people wish that there was more science in the book. I mean, the thing is, if I stuck with just what is real as we know it now, you know, what scientists know now, then this book could never have existed. You know, so it's in a way born out of that little bit of kind of imaginative liberty that you can take in a novel. You know, so if I took the science to the extreme, I would have said, oh, that would never happen. I bet I can't write this story. And so that feels like, you know, a book like this can only live if you are willing to give it a little bit of sort of imaginative liberty. But yeah, some people wish there was more science. I mean, I didn't want to make up science. I mean, I made up some things like there's a certain sort of mysterious sickness that happens that they can't explain. So I made things up like that, but I didn't want to give an explanation that was made up. You know, I wanted it to sort of what science there was in there to make sense. And I did show it. I showed it to an astrophysicist who is also a kind of a great lover of fiction. And he was really good at helping me in a few places if I had kind of misstated something that really is and something that sort of the scientists are certain about. He would help me, you know, fix that. But he was good at knowing, you know, the difference between fiction and, you know, nonfiction paper on the subject. And in a way, he felt like anytime there was a feeling of uncertainty or scientists not knowing the answer, that in a way that was the most realistic.
Yeah.
More than if the scientists were like, here's what's happening.
Yeah.
Because the whole premise would be so mysterious.
Absolutely. Well, the book is The Age of Miracles. It seems like it's made for a movie, and I don't say that in any minimizing way. I say that with a lot of affection for it. Do you want to break any news, any plans?
Well, the book has been optioned by a company called River Road. They are still in I don't want to misuse my movie terms, the development stage. so there's a screenplay, and the director, Catherine Hardwicke, who directed the first Twilight movie, so they're hoping to do it, and I hope they do it. Still in the sort of putting all the elements together stage, but I really hope they do it. And it would be exciting if I had some news soon, but we'll see.
Well, this was your first book, at least that I know of. And and Karen, it has been so successful, the reviews so good, that I'm very curious to know if that liberates you for future projects, or do you feel the expectation that you have to match it?
I definitely have been just really fortunate with how things have gone for the book. I think at the beginning it was so strange, and I mean in a wonderful way, but also very odd way, you know, that so many people were reading my book and that some people really loved it. It was a strange thing to kind of incorporate into my writing process as I worked on another book. I think as that was like an initial phase, it was hard. I felt like I had readers in my head all the time when I was trying to write. Whereas when I wrote The Age of Miracles, you know, this one, I had no idea if anyone would ever read it, you know, other besides my husband and my friends. So there was a freedom in that. And sometimes if I catch myself being too conservative in my thinking about a book, like if I get an idea and then I say, oh, some people will not go for that, you know, or some people will say that doesn't make sense, but if I'm excited about it, then I try to remind myself that I wrote The Age of Miracles in that sort of wilderness where there wasn't someone to say, you know, oh, that doesn't make sense, or
right.
You're not going to pull that off. I think at the moment I feel sort of deeply involved in another project, and I try to imagine that I'm back to where I was before, writing for who knows if I'll have any audience, even though this time I do have, you know, an editor waiting for it and everything. So I think, for the most part, it's been great, but there was a sort of an adjustment period with the writing after publishing a book, for sure.
There are more than 1,000 customer reviews on Amazon for your book, which is, I don't know if I've ever seen that, which means a lot of people are reading it. Every author has a different approach to how you decide to sort through whether it's a published review, comments online, et cetera. Do you choose to read all the reviews?
No, I definitely don't read all the Amazon reviews. At the beginning, it's amazing as an author to think that a stranger is reading your book at all. You know, at the beginning, I remember thinking, like, what? I don't know those people, and they've read my book, you know? And that's sort of amazing at first. And then, you know, I certainly saw plenty of, I mean, it's nice to see the good ones. My mom reads, I think she still reads them all. And she sometimes will send me a bad one, and she'll say, you know, this one was so unfair because X, Y, Z. And I thought, well, I probably wouldn't have even seen it. But I don't know. I mean, I definitely read the sort of, anytime I get sort of a big review, and because, you know, I'm excited to hear what people think. I think authors have to be careful about reading all the Amazon reviews, though. It just can be overwhelming, and you don't know if you would sort of agree with people's taste like, you don't know the people, so if they say they didn't like it, you have no context to say, like, oh, that's because we like different books, or, you know, anyway. So I think you have to sort of avoid the Amazon reviews.
You sure, well, part, but where are you better equipped to deal with this because of your past career as a book editor for Simon & Schuster, right?
Yes, that's right. Maybe. I mean, I certainly was, you know, I certainly saw, and obviously the nice reviews are really, it's really nice to get those. And I think the big thing that's different with reviews is that once the book is, like, when I was an editor, I was obviously giving my authors feedback all the time, and I got really great feedback from my own editor. But at that time, you still have time to change it. I think so. That's the big difference. Whereas once you publish a book and then you get reviews, and even if someone makes a good point, it's too late to change it, you know? So anyway, but yes, I was an editor. And I certainly felt sort of deep in on the sort of inside part of the good and the bad things about publishing a book before I ever published my own. And in a way, I think it made me sort of set my expectations low because I'd seen a lot of great books not reach the audience that I thought they deserved. So it's been a sort of big, every good thing that's happened to the book, including this Rochester selection, has been a kind of nice, a feeling of sort of a nice surprise to it every time. So.
Well, before I get back to the events and running them down for you, if you want to get involved with If All of Rochester Reads the Same Book, it's The Age of Miracles. And Karen Thompson Walker, the author, who's on the line with us again, as a former editor and someone now who is an author of high acclaim. Karen, we have a number of people, aspiring authors, who listen to the program, who we occasionally touch on writing, publishing, the vagaries of that world. And you, as an editor, occasionally you had to be tough on other writers. And you, as an author, it sounds like you really embraced the value of an editing process. What would you tell aspiring writers about the value of editing, even if it's tough?
Oh, well, I think editing is just essential. I mean, I think it starts with the author herself. Just learning to edit your own work is one of the most important parts of becoming a writer, I think. So I think a lot of revising even before it sees an editor's and then the other, you know, an official editor's hands is really important. And then there's some things that only someone else, especially someone who is an experienced editor, who, in a way, once you're an editor, it's like being a professional reader, you know. There's certain things that only someone who's a really, really good reader, who and ideally is working as an editor, can see, you know. And I think there's no way to do it on your own, some of those things. And so I had a really thorough editor, and she really pushed me in a great way. And I know my book is much better for her work.
Well, Karen Thompson Walker's book is The Choice of Writers and Books. Joe Flaherty from Writers and Books is here. And Joe, let's go over the events one more time for people to understand what's coming up here.
Okay. I'll go through when Karen is going to be in town.
She has, yeah, great.
Yeah, because it's going to be, you know, the multiple chances to see and hear her. Starting Wednesday, March 18th in the afternoon, she will be at St. John Fisher College. And then later that same afternoon at Nazareth College, which right across the street. And then that evening at the Penfield Public Library. And then on Thursday, she'll be at the Central Library for a noontime visit downtown. And then at 3 o'clock out at Rochester Institute of Technology. And then there will be on Friday at the Wood Library, 11 o'clock in Canandaigua, in the afternoon at 3 o'clock at Valley Manor, and then that evening at 7 o'clock at the Greece Public Library. And as I tell the authors who come regularly for this year after year, and I'll say it now to Karen, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And probably hearing all those events, you're thinking, oh my God, what did I get myself into?
No. When I did see the list, I was like, "Wow, this is a lot." But I mean, to get to reach so many people. So
yeah, and what mm-hmm. the authors who have preceded you say, it's just, I mean, what a wonderful experience that when you're in front of a group of people, every one of them has read the book. I mean, it's not as if you have to introduce it to them. It's more of them knowing it and having questions about it or comments or, I love this and thank you so much and why did you do this? So it's a very different kind of experience than, you know, going on a book tour maybe and just having to get people interested in the book. In this case, they're all readers of it.
They even told me I had to read the book before the interview. I kid, Karen. I don't have authors on unless I've read their book, and this was a great pleasure to me.
Oh, thank you. That's a great question.
Well, Karen Thompson Walker is coming, and Alicia writes to us real quick. She says, can't wait to meet her. I missed if she's working on anything else that will be out soon. So real quick, Karen, answer Alicia's question.
It won't be out soon because I'm still writing it, but I'm about halfway through another book, which is unrelated, has a different premise, but it does have something in common with The Age of Miracles, which is it's a sort of story about ordinary people facing an extreme situation, but a different kind of situation.
Thanks for taking the time for us, and we'll see you in Rochester soon.
Great. Thank you so much.
Karen Thompson Walker, the author of The Age of Miracles. Joe, thank you for always organizing this, and
it is great fun.
Thanks. Because, you know, there are so many different important things to talk about, but when you can really immerse in a book, this pulls me back and reminds me of just the value of that. That's why I said to Karen, you know, I can't imagine boredom. I've got a pile of books that I'll never even get through. How big is your queue of books that you want to read but haven't?
On my bedside, I don't even want to tell you how many.
I think there's probably 12 on my nightstand right now, and you've at least pointed us in a direction to pick up a book that reads very quickly. Well written, really solid. The prose is just really solid. You can tell she's
beautifully written.
Super solid, super solid. Have fun with this event with her. Oh, actually, these events with her. The series of events. Writers and books, and always a great success there. Thanks, Joe. Nice talking to you.
Thank you, Evan.
Always fun. And Val, I'm serious. You can pick up my copy when you're done here. You're going to love this book. This is made for Val LaBanca, who does a great job engineering this program. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you on Arts Friday on Member Supported Public Radio.